Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Invasive species. What image does that conjure in your head? On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're hunting down both land and aquatic creatures who don't belong here and whose very presence threatens our local land and water. First, we'll attend a competition where local chefs presented Asian carp in all sorts of inventive ways. Asian carp are huge monster fish currently taking over waterways across America, driving out native species, and even proving deadly to boaters. Then, Chef Tenny Flynn joins us with another invader, the lovely, delicious but dangerous lionfish. Tenny's part of a team that spearfishes for those devils, but then Tenny actually cooks and serves them to his customers at G.W. Finn's, his New Orleans restaurant. And what about the hippo? Louisiana dodged a bullet with that one. We'll tell you all about the close call known as the American Hippo Bill of 1910. So instead of my usual rallying call, eat it to save it, we're gonna eat it to eradicate it on this week's Louisiana Eats. The Gulf of Mexico provides Louisiana restaurants with a dazzling variety of fish that our all-star chefs prepare in inventive and delicious ways. Grouper, flounder, snapper, who could ask for anything more? But what if your favorite chef presented you with an unfamiliar fish that was both delicious and helped solve one of our state's growing environmental problems? Would you give it a try? That's a question that a number of scientists, environmentalists, and chefs have been asking as they work to combat Louisiana's invasive species problem. As part of the National Food and Beverage Invasive Species Project, New Orleans Southern Food and Beverage Museum hosted a cook-off featuring a fish that's becoming a growing menace in the Gulf, Asian carp. Four local chefs were tasked with preparing the invasive fish from fin to plate. WWTV's resident chef, Kevin Belton, emceed the event.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Best of the Bycatch. Now, if you all have never had the opportunity to eat this fish, you are in for a treat tonight. The chefs will be delivered a fish. They have 1 hour to prepare a dish. Also, tonight, we're going to have a demonstration on exactly how the fish has to be treated and gutted, because it has a few extra bones in it. So enjoy the evening, make their way around, eat, drink, and be a typical Louisianian.
As visitors tried free samples, we ducked into our SOFAP studio with one of the scientists, hoping to raise awareness of the Asian carp's effect on our wetlands.
My name is Alicia Renfro. I'm a coastal scientist with the National Wildlife Federation. So the Asian carp, it's actually four different species of fish that come mostly from Southeast Asia. They become really big. They can average around 50 pounds. And they're filter feeders. So they go through the environment and they suck up these microscopic plants and animals. So they take up the room and they take up the food source. And so the other species that would naturally occur here can't thrive like they once did. And then with an added bonus, at least with the silver carp, they actually jump out of the water. So if you're boating through an area, you could have a 50-pound fish end up in your lap, which is very dangerous.
Dangerous and terrifying. Which places in Louisiana is this likely to happen to you?
the Mississippi River itself, some of the upper parts of the basin, I think now even into the Pearl River, they are pretty thoroughly moving through the freshwater systems of Louisiana these days.
How exactly did they swim across the borders?
What really happened is they were brought in intentionally in the 70s into aquaculture farms farther up into the upper Mississippi River. And they were brought in intentionally because they are filter feeders. And they did that for a little while, and then they got out of their little dammed areas and into the freshwater system. And because they can go through and eat up so much and reproduce so quickly, they began spreading throughout the freshwater systems we have here, all the way up the upper Mississippi River, almost into the Great Lakes. The National Wildlife Federation is really trying hard not to let these fish get into the Great Lakes.
What are you all doing to try to combat this? How do you get people to eat Asian carp to eradicate them?
At the National Wildlife Federation, we do have a focus on creating environments and healthy habitats for the animals and wildlife and fish in our ecosystem, and also to connect people. One of the things we've been really focusing in on are innovative ways to control these invasive species. And for many of them, the only way you can get rid of them is to actually go in and physically take them out. And when you have something like the Asian carp, you can eat it, so why not eat it?
It's such a great idea. Is anybody fishing them commercially yet?
I don't think I know of anybody fishing them commercially. Some recreational fishermen will go after them just for fun or maybe just to cook them up for themselves, but I don't know of any commercial effort at this point.
So at this point, are you involving chefs in order to educate the public so that the fishermen might start catching them and eating them?
Yeah, that's the goal. It's a fish that people don't think about eating, and it's a very big fish, and it can be a great fish, especially in the hands of some of our New Orleans chefs.
Ladies and gentlemen, just remember tonight, this is a fish that does have a lot of bones in it, so just be careful and be aware of that.
Another expert we spoke with at the event was Chef Philippe Parola, who has dedicated his career to the concept that the Asian carp problem can be solved by eating them.
My name is Chef Philippe. I'm out of Baton Rouge. When I came in Louisiana in 1980 from Paris, I discovered the wildlife and the fishing and the hunting and the beautiful outdoor in Louisiana. And then I discovered about this invasive species when the alligator became a nuisance in the early 80s and the black-tipped shark and then the nutria, the famous nutria. And that's when the wildlife and fishery contacted me. We launched a 3-year nutria promotion, and then today I'm working with the Asian carp. I just like to take natural resources like this and turn it to food, like the Asian carp, for instance. You know, you got the government spending $500 million trying to resolve this particular problem scientifically, but they can't. There is no eradication. And I think it would be great to put Louisiana on the spotlight by saying, look, we have the solution, and the solution is simple. It's a practical one, not a scientific one. It's to turn those fish into food product that consumers will love to have. So you're going to create a ton of job with that, number one. You're going to boost the economy. You're going to harvest those fish on a daily basis, I guarantee you. If you put a price tag on it, our friend the Kunas down the bayou, they're going to go and go after it. That's the key. It really is. Fish is food. You know that, right?
Right.
That's all.
And this is a good fish to eat.
Well, it is, absolutely. There is no such a thing as a bad fish. In 1990, I got invited to tour the seafood market in Tokyo, the largest seafood market in the world. When we did that, we went there by 3 o'clock in the morning when the boat arrived, okay? They unload all the seafood, the fish, and they got fish from all over the place. What they drag into those nets, go to that market. And I'm going to tell you, I seen some fish I never seen before. They were so ugly. It was like, what? You eat that stuff? Well, let me tell you something, puppy. After 2 hours, all of those fish were gone. Lesson to learn. There is no such a thing as a bad fish. All right, now let's talk about this, the Asian carp. It's called a carp, number one. So who wants to eat carp in America? We're spoiled here, girl.
I know we are.
Big
in
time.
Louisiana, especially.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's the first thing. Number two, it's invasive species. When you classify that as invasive species, oh my God, we don't want to touch it. So when we want to attempt to touch that, the biggest problem with this fish is the bone structure. I never seen such a complex bone structure on any fish. So when I encountered this fish 6 years ago in Louisiana for the first time, I went and gave it to some of my dear friends. And I wanted to do a test trial to see if that fish whole, they could work with it. Every one of them came back with too difficult to work with, you know, too time consuming. And that was the dead end. So what we did over 6 years' time is we developed a way to remove the bones and make fish product, like fish cakes, like we're going to serve tonight, be able to mass process those fish cakes and harvest those fish on a commercial basis. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds per day. That will make the difference. That will create thousands of jobs. That will boost the economy. Our policymakers, because this is not a problem yet, they are not doing anything. And it's okay, but being active into the fishing, recreational fisheries, understanding the value of outdoor in Louisiana, our beauty about our swamp and bayou, as I can tell you, I got two young daughters, and I will sure not let that fish coming and destroying all of this. This is what it's all about. It really is.
The four chefs who participated in the cook-off hailed from Carmo, Alma, Spotted Cat Food and Spirits, and Lucy's retired Surfer's Bar and Restaurant. Each chef was provided with their own Asian carp, and let me tell you, these things are huge. Not to mention slimy and ugly. Watching as the chefs prepared these monsters into something edible was a sight to see. We spoke with three of them at their stations to better understand their experience with carp.
My name is Dana Hahn from Carmo, a restaurant down in the Warehouse District. And we are preparing this evening a dish called Lomo Saltado, which is a Peruvian, kind of Peruvian version of pepper steak. A little bit more interesting than your average pepper steak because it has ají amarillo, has a bunch of other fresh peppers and tomatoes and all kinds of herbs in it. And then, of course, we're using tonight the silver Asian carp, which will provide an interesting twist.
Have you ever cooked with silver Asian carp before?
Other than the test fish that they sent over the other day, this is the first time.
What's your impression of it?
I think it's really great. I think that, you know, there's definitely a little trick in terms of learning to fillet it out so that you actually get a good yield out of the fish. But aside from that, the flesh is really firm. It has a really nice texture, a really nice, fairly mild flavor. I think that I did it fried, I tried it grilled, I tried it in this woked dish. So it seems to be very versatile.
Hi, this is Chef Melissa Arrigo from Silver Catering and Alma Pop-Up. I have found out that this is actually a very intensive processed fish. It's not like your regular fish that you fillet nice and smooth. There's a lot of bones embedded in the meat, and to clean up, you have to deal with a rib cage and everything. So techniques helps, but then after that, it's just intuition.
Yeah. And what are you making with it today?
Today I'm making fish tacos.
Hey, how you doing? I'm Rob Clement from Spotted Cat Food and Spirits on St. Claude. What we did today is a carp croquette with fra diavolo with a tarragon creme fraiche. Overall, it was a pretty interesting experience working with the carp. It's got a lot of bones in it. So that's kind of how I ended up doing the croquettes. It just seemed for this number of plates and the time limit for the judges, it just seemed make a better product if we just broke down the fish all the way and kind of put it back together, something flavorful that made sense.
If you were to compare it to another kind of fish we're familiar with, what would you compare it to?
Actually, so the skeletal structure of it's very similar to a tilapia. I worked in a seafood market for a while, and they have actually like a rib cage that like bows out, whereas a lot of fish, it's kind of flat and it's really easier going one knife stroke down the fish. So that's different than a lot of fish, and it can be challenging. I've never really encountered a fish with as many bones throughout it, honestly. I mean, just being honest. Yeah. But to me, it was pretty much like a blank canvas with the flavor. It's not very assertive. It's not something that, like, is overly fishy to where you're kind of stuck doing certain things. So it was pretty cool to work with.
A crowd mobbed Chef Jessica Richardson's station, reaching for free plates. She'd poached the fish to remove its tiny little bones before constructing the flesh into a carp cake. She then battered and fried the cakes, finishing each with a slice of Creole tomato on top. After sampling the dishes, the three judges, one of whom was me, declared Jessica Richardson's fish cake the winner. Attendees went home satiated, and the event was deemed a success. But I have to admit, I'm still left with the burning question. What about you? Would you be willing to try some Asian carp? After a short break, we'll catch up with Chef Tenny Flynn of GW Finns. Tenny's experiences with invasive species range from spear hunting lionfish to serving up some wild dishes for Dr. John. Stay tuned.
Grandpa done did what he done gotta do, but I'm gonna do what my grandpa didn't do. Gonna catch time, gonna meet my wish. I'm gonna set a trap for that big ugly fish.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine, overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. Chef Tenny Flynn is known for his adventuring, both inside and outside the kitchen. As an avid fisherman, diver, and spear hunter, Tenny has a license to kill. Fish, that is. Before serving them up at his own restaurant, GW Finns, something quite unique amongst chefs. But he doesn't merely hunt for sport. With the growing number of invasive species wreaking havoc on our ecosystem, Tenny has set his sights on impeding these threats, one kill and one plate at a time. We spoke with Tenny about some of the wilder dishes he's prepared and his mission to eradicate non-native organisms invading the Gulf of Mexico. He began by describing a particularly nasty threat to our waters, the highly invasive lionfish.
This fish will eat anything that fits in its mouth. It wakes up in the morning and eats 6 game fish. It eats 6 grouper, it eats 6 snapper, it eats 6 triggerfish, it eats 6 whatever. And then at night before it goes to bed, it eats 6 more. It is incredibly prolific breeder. It releases egg sacs that can float 200 miles. The fish don't even have to be anywhere close by. They have no natural enemies in this hemisphere.
Except for you.
Well, and they need to develop a trap because they're happy at any depth, much deeper than we can go. They're getting bigger all the time, too. I mean, the record size gets broken about once a month.
So did you actually begin your diving career because of this?
Of lionfish, yeah.
That incredible. I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, and I enjoy diving. I do it whenever I get the chance, and I don't have to kill things. Of course, as we know, as hunters, killing things is fun. But I guess it was about 6 years ago, I was approached by people to do a lionfish rodeo. And I grew up, I watched Sea Hunt, you know, and I'd always kind of wanted to learn to dive, but never did. And did the lionfish rodeo and cooked like 800 lionfish and made friends with John Peruccio, who's the president of South Bend Equipment Company, and another friend of his. They sort of took me under their wing. I got certified to dive. I started diving in South Florida because they are dangerous. You do not want
to
get...
What will a lionfish do to a human?
It depends on the size of the fish and how deep the spines go in. But I've stuck myself with a dead one, and it's kind of like a bee sting. I was diving a few weeks ago in Pensacola, and the dive master seriously impaled himself on one, and he was hospitalized, and you know, said the pain medication did nothing. And
how extensive is this lionfish problem today?
Well, in Florida, they have eradication programs. In Florida, they also have recreational divers, which we really don't in Louisiana because of the nature of our coast. The good thing is they're extremely good to eat. It's a mild, sweet flesh fish. It kind of lends itself more to sauteing than it does grilling or more, you know, high heat aggressive methods. It's also really good in ceviche. It's considered good citizenship to kill everyone you see, regardless of the size. So the little guys, we make ceviche out of. The big ones, we usually do a whole fried presentation. And there's some, you know, question. The venom, and it's not poison, it's venom. It's in the spines. It's not in the meat. Once the spines are removed, even if you left them there, they're denatured by heat anyway. So we do them whole fried. It's kind of a, you know, cut slits in them, season them real well. And
Tenny, you are one of my favorite chefs because you are such a wild adventurer in many, many ways. And that includes things that you might not often see on a plate. Tell me about some of the other invasive critters that you have experienced with cooking.
Well, I mean, one of our purveyors is buddies with Dr. John, and he's got some dietary restrictions. I mean, the man's a 77-year-old rock and roll musician. That's like, you know, that's worse than dog years. You know, it's if you ever seen like a close-up of Keith Richards, you know, and he had some habits that didn't lend themselves to a long and healthy life. And he decided at some point that he was going to totally change his diet, which he did. Also stopped taking drugs and drinking, which I'm sure had a lot to do with that as well. But he only likes to eat wild food. He's especially fond of raccoons, which are not really invasive, but there are plenty of them. The only possum I ever served anybody in my life, I made for him.
and how'd you cook that possum?
Well, anything that I'm unfamiliar with like that, I generally brine it for a little while, and then I season it and brown it off pretty well, and then I braise it until it's tender and delicious. It was interesting because I wanted some feedback on the possum, and I can't say on the radio the exact words he used for describing it, but I said, well, and how did the other guests like it? And they said, well, they said it tasted like brisket. And it was one his daughter said, well, they're Jewish. So I'm going like, well, you know, I'm not really up on my dietary laws, but I'm pretty damn sure that possum don't get it. You know,
you don't think possum is kosher?
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, it's a marsupial for one thing. But anyway, back to the invasive part, nutria, you know, which, you know, we've all been encouraged to cook and eat a few times over the years since I've been here. An aquatic rodent that's a vegetarian, and I've cooked several of those for him too. And I've had, it seems to me like the little ones are better than the big ones, but I don't know. You really don't know until you cook, you know, hundreds or thousands of something before you can really make that determination. But I got away from the brining, you know, because I was afraid of, you know, and I wanted more of the natural flavor of the Mr. Raccoon to come out. So I don't bother with brining anymore, which, you know, does change the flavor quite a bit.
And how did Mr. Raccoon and Mr. Possum come to the kitchen door?
Well, actually, Lance Nocio, usually it's I can get that. It's a lot of over-promising and under-delivering, but Lance can, and he brings them dressed.
Our favorite shrimper friend, Lance Nocio.
And I think I still have one in the freezer. I haven't talked to Mac in 6 months or so. He's out on the road, but when he comes back, he'll have his raccoon.
His coon will be there waiting for him. Well, Tenny, I knew you were just the man to ask about these things. So thank you for sharing this amazing wealth of knowledge about those invasive creatures with us. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again soon.
Well, and whenever you see lionfish on a menu, be sure and eat it, right?
Will do. Let's eat them to eradicate them. That's Tenny Flynn, lionfish hunter, chef, and co-owner of GW Finn's in the French Quarter. A little food for thought. Food for thought. Come on. Food for thought. Food for thought. A little food for thought. Food for thought. Food for thought. Food for thought. Of all the non-native menaces to our state, there's none more reviled, or admired, than the orange-toothed nutria. Imported to Louisiana in the early 1900s for their fur, these fast-breeding rodents took to our marshes like a fish to water, accelerating coastal erosion in the process. We've been combating this little interloper in a variety of ways, unsuccessfully, ever since. But one enterprising entrepreneur may have come up with the best plan yet to accelerate their eradication. Hansel Harlan decided that maybe man's best friend was the solution.
My name is Hansel Harlan. I'm the president and co-founder of Mars Dog, along with my sister, Venny Harlan.
Well, Hansel, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today on Louisiana Eats. I am simply fascinated by your business. Marsh Dog is in the business of making dog treats.
That is absolutely right.
How did this business come about?
Well, during college, I was in graduate school in Argentina. It was down there that I first learned that nutria in Louisiana actually came from Argentina. Growing up, I always knew about nutria, but I thought that they were indigenous to Louisiana.
How did they get here?
They were brought in sort of like, you know how people will like farm chinchilla for the fur?
Yes.
Or so this was sort of like that. They imported them in the early 1900s to raise in captivity for their fur. And they ended up getting loose in Louisiana and going into the marshes.
Well, they sure do know how to multiply, don't they?
Absolutely. Well, see, when they were in Argentina, they don't have near the problem with nutria that we have here because their wetlands there aren't coastal wetlands. They're wetlands in the interior. And their size is controlled by the seasons. During the dry seasons, the wetlands can shrink considerably. So the population of nutria, therefore, kept in check by natural elements. Whereas in Louisiana, they've really just stumbled into nirvana. It's a perfect climate all year round, wetlands all year round, and they multiply at just an astronomical rate. And so the real problem with nutria is that they're just voracious herbivores. They do three things, basically. They sleep, have baby nutria, and eat. But they don't only eat just leaves off of plants. They're pretty selective in what they like. So they actually like to pull up the marsh grasses and eat the tender roots. They're very picky about what they like. But that ends up basically denuding large areas of the wetlands. So what had happened from the time that they got in Louisiana in the early 1900s all the way through the late 70s, early 80s, were that the population was kept in check by people that hunted them and harvested them for their furs. There were millions of nutria that were taken every year by trappers and skinned, and the skins were cured and treated, and they were sold all over the United States and all over the world for fashion. But once that stopped, there were no more predators to keep the nutria population in check. So commensurately, their numbers just exploded. So the biologists, when they were looking at all the land that we were losing, identified nutria as one of the culprits and says, look, oh my gosh, the fur industry is gone. These nutria are unchecked. We've got to figure out a way to solve this problem. So they toyed with a number of different solutions. They talked about poisoning them for a while on some of this large scale. They tried to develop an industry where they were going to capture them, bring them in, clean them, and try to sell them for human consumption.
Oh, yes. Even Paul Prudhomme got involved in that effort, I recall.
That's exactly right.
Nutria sauce piquant.
The state was investing millions of dollars in the project at the time.
And then in 1998, they actually put a bounty out on the nutria.
And that was the final solution when they realized that people weren't going to eat them. They said, you know what? We give up. We're just going to pay people to go kill them.
So how's that going?
Well, the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries does a great job with the bounty program, the nutria control program. The problem is that it costs an arm and a leg. What they are doing basically every year is they go through and they figure out how many nutria they have to cull. And right now, I think the numbers last time I checked were about 350 to 400,000, depending on the year. They can go in and see the population and how fast it's growing, and they know how many they have to kill in order to basically mow the grass. They're not defeating the problem. They're just keeping it in check. And so when you multiply that times the bounty, the costs that are paid out of the bounty program alone are close to $2 million. Each year.
And what are they doing with all those dead nutria?
They just leave them. Oh. They just leave them. They kill them, and they cut the tail off, and they bring it back in, and they get collected.
Wow. And how did you make this connection between dog treats and nutria?
Well, we were looking at the numbers involved with the bounty program, and we were thinking, oh my gosh, if there was only some sort of way where we could harness the forces of capitalism in order to help solve an environmental problem, that being coastal erosion. So we said, well, if we could go down and we could contract with the guys who were already going out there and harvesting the nutria and just chopping off the tail, then maybe we could get them to bring in the body and we could have it processed and turn it into some sort of either dog food or dog treat. Because what was happening, actually, the end of the deal is that I had a dog at the time who was having food allergies because there was a problem with a lot of dog food manufacturers, and I don't want to say a problem, but they use grains in dog food manufacturing, and grains are not a part of a dog's natural diet. And so dogs will end up having allergic reactions to corn, soy, or wheat, which is a large filler in a lot of dog foods. When we finally isolated that was the problem with my dog, I started feeding it home-brewed sort of goulash that I was making from turkey meat. Mm. And so at the same time, I'm reading these various stories every month or two about the nutria, and I saw in connection with the state's efforts to market it as for human consumption, they were talking about how similar it was to turkey meat. And I'm like, well, wait a second. If it's like turkey meat and my turkey meat is so good for my dog, why can't I use nutria meat?
So what year was it when you started concocting dog treats, and how did you come up with the recipe?
I guess it's about 5 years ago right now. And what had happened is I started talking to my sister, Venny, who is a huge dog person. She's also a graphic designer. I said, wouldn't this be fun if we could get a company together and we could go down and contract with these guys and get nutria meat and make these dog treats and sell them? And so we talked about it for about 4 or 5 months. And as I was reading the paper one day, and they have an organization, a federal-state cooperative entity called the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program. And it's a federal-state group that was formed in order to combat particular problems that plague that ecosystem. And so they had a mini grant program where every year they would have a contest. And if you had a really good idea that would help that estuary in some particular way, you would submit an application. And if they liked it, they would give you a grant. So my sister and I said, oh, well, let's submit an application and see what they think. Got together and created a business plan and an application and sent it in, and we won.
That must have been a big turning point.
Well, it's sort of like the dog that's running after the bus, right? and you catch it, and we're like, oh, my gosh, what do we do now? Because they were said, here you go. Here's your money. When are you going to get started? We're like, oh, where do we even start? So that just started us off on a long journey of going down, getting to know the problem, getting to know the trappers, getting to know the fur industry, making contacts, figuring out how this was actually going to be done.
So the two of you all developed the recipe?
Yes, we did. I sort of took the lead on that with my sister adding ideas and using all of our dogs as test rabbits, so to speak.
I bet they didn't mind.
No, not at all. So over the course of about 6 to 9 months, we came up with a working recipe that we had some concepts that we wanted to implement. We wanted to do all of our ingredients from Louisiana. We wanted it as natural as possible. We wanted to keep it preservative-free at the time. We didn't realize that we were really just putting huge obstacles in front of us with every one of these decisions that we made. But we were able to make it work. So we came out with some biscuits at first. And then we segued into some jerky as well.
Now, where are these treats made?
First, they were made at the kitchen at my home. But we quickly outgrew that. And we created a facility here in Baton Rouge. But we've outstripped our capacity there. So we're presently contracting with some manufacturers to try to pick up our production for us.
And where can people find Marsh Dog Treats?
We are in most independent pet stores in Louisiana. We're in 4 or 5 other states right now, and we have internet sales through most all of the states in the country as well as internationally.
Well, congratulations. There's nothing like a homegrown treat. Hansel, do you have any idea how many nutria you're going through now a year to create Marsh Dog Treats?
That is really hard to say exactly. It's in the hundreds of thousands of pounds. I'll tell you, some people have come to us and will sort of question the efficacy of our business project. And they say, well, gosh, what are you guys going to do if you run out of nutria? And we said, well, you know what? That's the whole point. It should be our motto. Put us out of business, right? Because if we run out of nutria, then the problem is solved.
Well, Hansel, you have such a wonderful homegrown success story. And I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to share it with all my Louisiana Eats listeners.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Hansel Harlan of Marsh Dog Treats. In 1910, U.S. Representative Robert Broussard of Louisiana introduced what would become known as the American Hippo Bill to Congress. What did this bill aim to accomplish? Stay tuned, and we'll tell you about this bizarre bit of food history when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What was the goal of the American Hippo Bill, introduced to Congress in 1910? To get an understanding of this bizarre bit of Louisiana food history, we have to go back to 1884. That year, New Orleans hosted its first World's Fair, also known as the World Industrial and Cotton Centennial. More than a million visitors descended on what is now Audubon Park to see exhibits from all over the world. Those who stopped by the Japanese pavilion received as a parting gift an ornamental plant with lavender blossoms called water hyacinth. While it may not look very intimidating, this aquatic plant, native to the Amazon River basin, is actually an aggressive invader that rapidly covers whole waterways. Soon after its introduction, water hyacinth was spanning across South Louisiana, choking bayous, killing fish, and impeding shipping. The problem continued for decades. Even the U.S. War Department joined the eradication efforts, dumping oil all over the plants, but to no effect. It seemed like the state had exhausted all of its options. That is until 1910. At the turn of the 20th century, a rapidly growing population was straining America's meat supply. Native animals like the buffalo were all but extinct, and ranchers couldn't keep up with the nation's demands for meat. Enter the hippo. Following the advice of a pair of big game hunters, Congressman Robert Broussard of New Iberia proposed an ingenious solution to both Louisiana's invasive hyacinth problem and the American meat shortage. Broussard sponsored the American Hippo Bill, which, if approved, would set aside federal funds for the importation of the humble hippopotamus. Imagine bayous full of hippos munching on those pesky hyacinth flowers, and American tables supplied with an exotic new source of protein. Hippo meat? You bet. No less a big game expert than Teddy Roosevelt himself endorsed the idea, and the New York Times salivated over what they dubbed Lake Cow Bacon. Sound too far-fetched? It almost came to pass. Literally. Broussard's bill gained a lot of notoriety, but ultimately fell just short of passage. Louisiana's hyacinth problem persists, and the only hippos I've seen lately are living it up at the Audubon Zoo. I'm Poppy Tooker, and I don't know about you, but I am glad to say that hippo gumbo is not real Louisiana eats.
And I'm Justin Pitts. I'm a fifth generation from Jones County, Mississippi. I'm a stockman farmer. I raise heritage breeds of livestock, pretty much all the breeds that you would have found in the Deep South prior to 1900.
It's one thing when an entirely new species enters an ecosystem, but what happens when an old predator returns to once familiar territory? Through conservation efforts in Mississippi, the red wolf and black bear are back. But according to Justin Pitts, that's not something to celebrate.
The red wolf has hybridized with the coyote and with feral timber wolf German shepherd hybrids that people have bought as pets, got scared of, whatever, they've thrown them out. A true coyote weighs between 20 and 30 pounds. I captured and dispatched one that weighed 72 that was killing sheep. There's no telling at the tens of thousands of dollars that the red wolf coyote hybrids have cost me in raising sheep and poultry. I've lost three calves this year to these, I don't know what the proper word for them would be. They're not coyotes, they're not wolves. Fur Fishing Game has begun to reference them as brush wolves.
Brush wolves, that's a whole new term, isn't it?
It is, and they, you know, kind of think this is Darwin's theory at work. This is a new species evolving.
This experience with the reintroduction of these wild animals, wolves, bears, even your grandfather had an opinion, because that must have happened during his time on your family land.
It did. I can remember watching a television program that they had on our evening news station where they had reintroduced the black bear. My grandfather was just livid. His grandparents, who were my great-great-grandparents, he said, you know, they worked to eradicate these animals to where we could raise our livestock, and now they're reintroducing them. And the problem with the reintroduction is if the bear destroys livestock, you cannot kill the bear. He's federally protected. I have 40-some-odd cotton patch geese. Now, they may not mean anything to anybody else, but that was my great-grandfather's geese that they turned into the cotton fields. It would take just a matter of minutes for some of these wolf-dog hybrids to destroy the flock. Several years ago, a young lady that I kept company with, she and I went out of town. And while she and I were gone, these red wolves, coyote hybrids, got in my chicken yard and killed 140-some-odd pullets. They didn't eat the chickens. They just killed them. They stacked them 4 and 5 to the pile. It was a pair of parents training the young how to kill. Now, eventually, I did take Papa out, but Mama and the young got away. I don't know what it's going to take, because you have people who have this Disney, the fox and the hound, and that's another thing we have trouble with up home is the red fox. That's not native. He has displaced the little native gray. The red fox was brought here by the English because they didn't like the way that the little gray, who is the only canine with retractable claws, could shinny up a tree. So they brought their red fox over here so they could course their hounds. Red foxes prey on the piglets, the poultry. They'll get kids and lambs and house cats. Red foxes love house cats.
Oh, no.
And they have cleaned me out. I have one cat left, and she's traveling when she goes from one building to the next.
Wow.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to have a chance to show the stockman's perspective of this. Yes, I do like to hear the wail of the coyote on a cold night. I like to hear that. But at the same time I'm listening to him, I'm wondering, well, what's going to be gone tomorrow morning? What's he going to get into tonight?
Justin Pitts, fifth generation stockman and farmer from Jones County, Mississippi. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.